All right, good morning. Hope you all had a good weekend, stayed well hydrated. It's very important. And let's see, this is Bio 231. It is April 20th, and you've got a test next time. And I got a haircut, that's right. I wasn't going to get one, but I got one. Okay, so you got a test next time. What is going to be on the test? It's going to be chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, and 18. So what is that? That's central nervous system, peripheral nervous system, autonomic nervous system, special senses, and heart. Right? Are we all on the same page? Okay, fantastic. And a few labs still need to be finishing up. I think a practicum this week, maybe today and tomorrow. And then after Wednesday, we got one more test. One more practicum in the class, and then it's over. Holy cow. But don't forget any of this stuff. It's pretty important, especially if you're going to move on to a physiology class, because we just talk about this stuff like you know it. So it's important that you do know it. Okay? Yeah, question. Yeah, the drop date is the 25th, which is Friday. So I'm going to try to get your test graded as soon as possible and all your grades collated in Blackboard. And so you know what grade you have in order to make up your mind if you're going to stay in the class or drop. But if you're thinking about dropping, you might want to see me during office hours. And make sure if you see me to calculate your grade during office hours, you have all of your practicum scores and or at least what the average is. And your average quiz score in lab 2, all right? Because I might not have that handy. It's probably buried in a computer file someplace.
Will that be on the website, the practicum?
Yeah, if I get the information from your lab instructors, I don't have it from all lab instructors yet, but I asked them. So, if you see your lab instructor, you might want to just remind them that they should email me your total points for the practicum and your total points for quizzes so that I can put it into Blackboard, okay? And then you'll have all that. All right, so last time we were talking about the heart, and I think I was drawing some stuff on the board. Is that right? Was that where we left off?
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we left off something like, how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have?
Yeah,
that's right. And how many, you can break all the valves down into two categories. What are the two categories of valves? Okay, those are names. The tricuspid and bicuspid, those are names of valves. But if we were going to categorize, how could we break down the four valves into two categories? Okay, pulmonary, semilunar valve. That's a name, but not a category. Okay, so you could say, okay, how about break them down into a pulmonary circulation and a systemic circulation? That's kind of a nice way of doing it. So the pulmonary circulation would be on what side, the right or left? The right. And then the systemic would be on the left side of the heart. All right, so I learned something just now. That's not how I was thinking of doing it, but that's a very valid way of categorizing. I was going to categorize it as either atrioventricular or semilunar, right? Maybe that's another way of thinking about how to categorize these. Okay. All right, what's the definition of an artery? It's a vessel taking blood away from the heart, and a vein brings blood to the heart. And remember, that's a nice, strict, easy definition. You can't determine what's an artery or a vein by knowing what the state of the blood is in a particular vessel, whether it's oxygenated or not. Because there are veins that carry oxygen. What veins carry oxygen? Yeah, the pulmonary. Pulmonary what? Pulmonary? No, not the pulmonary artery, but the pulmonary veins carry oxygen. Because where are they coming back from? The lungs. And what do they do in the lungs? Yeah, they pick up oxygen. They pick up oxygen in the lungs. What kind of vessel is specialized for exchange? The capillaries in the lungs, right? So the pulmonary artery is taking carbon dioxide to the lungs. It leaves the capillary in the lungs. Oxygen goes into the blood, so the pulmonary veins carry oxygen. Okay, so that's all pretty good. I don't think we talked about the layers. of the heart. Did we talk about the layers of the heart? I don't think so. So let's talk about that right now. Ah, passed it by. Yeah, maybe not. Yeah. Yeah? Okay, what's the function? The function of the chambers is when they contract, they pressurize blood, and then blood is ejected from the heart. So when the heart contracts, that puts pressure into the blood, and blood will flow from a high pressure into low pressure. And when the ventricles reach high pressure, blood is ejected from the heart and pushed into an artery. So that's the function of the chambers, to pump blood. Okay, and what's the function of a valve? Yeah, you could say prevent backflow of blood, but another better word would be to say prevent retrograde flow of blood. What's going to happen to the heart if the valves aren't working properly? Did I talk about that? I'm not sure I did. It's going to kill the heart, right? If the valves don't work properly, that's eventually going to kill the heart, maybe sooner rather than later. So this is how I think about the job of the valves. Is it easier to walk down the stairs or to walk up the stairs? Yeah, walking down the stairs is a lot easier. Okay, so walking up the stairs is pretty hard and you use up a lot of energy and you get tired. Okay, but now let's say instead of stairs, you're going to walk up some sand dunes. Anybody ever walk up some sand dunes? What happens when you walk up a sand dune? You take one big step up and what happens? You slide back down, like two-thirds of a step. That's like having a leaky valve. So then what do? You step up again, and what happens? You slide back down. So is it harder to walk up a flight of stairs or sand dunes? Sand dunes, a lot. It's like 5 or 10 times harder. Okay. So could you imagine like walking up a sand dune hour after hour after hour for the rest of your life? Because what, does your heart ever take a break? No, can't ever take a break. That's like you walking up a sand dunes forever. What would happen to you? Well, you'd croak after a while, right? It's just too much work. Same thing happens to the heart when the valves are leaky. It's like running up a sand dune all the time. It just runs out of energy and it dies. So those valves have to be replaced or repaired. Okay. All right, so the layers of the heart, I think you probably know from anatomy, I mean from lab pretty well. There's really nothing holding the heart in position. It's not attached to a bone. Okay, it's attached to some membranes that surround the heart. And remember from way back when, there are two kinds of membranes, two general kinds of membranes in your body. Anybody remember some general names of membranes? Serous membranes versus mucous membrane, then there's some other ones like cutaneous membrane, synovial membrane that we learned about. But basically the two main ones are mucus and serous. Mucus lines a cavity that's open to the outside world, like your mouth, your nasal cavity, digestive tract, reproductive tract. Those are all mucous membranes because they're open to the outside world. All right, but a serous membrane lines a cavity that is not open to the outside world. So could you refresh my memory? What are some of these serous membranes in our body? Oh, come on. Come on, come on. Look alive. What, a serous membrane. It lines a cavity, not open. I tell you what, give me a cavity that's not open to the outside world. Thoracic cavity. Fantastic. Okay. Abdominal cavity. Okay. Pelvic cavity. Abdominopelvic cavity. It was what, the peritoneal cavity? All right. So, and their lungs. They're in a cavity that's not open to the outside world. That's the pleural cavity, right? And let's see, the cavity that the heart is in is called the pericardial cavity or pericardium, okay, pericardial cavity. These are serous membranes. And remember, serous membranes have three divisions to it. There is the membrane that lies right on the visceral organ. Visceral organ is an organ that's deep inside your body, like your heart, your intestines, right? Liver, stomach, things like that. Lungs deep inside your body. So the visceral layer is right on the surface of that visceral organ, and then you got a space filled with serous fluid, and then you have another lining, okay, that's called the parietal serous membrane. So from superficial to deep, what do you got? You got parietal serous membrane, you got the serous cavity with fluid, and then you got the visceral membrane. Okay, so the heart has all those, but because it's big and heavy and working a lot inside your thoracic cavity, there's another membrane that surrounds all those, and that's called the fibrous pericardium, and that's what the heart is suspended in, holds it in position so that it doesn't just pop right out of your chest, okay, because the heart is actually beating pretty forcefully. All right, so I see it. Do I see it right here? This is the fibrous pericardium. It's been cut away. And the fibrous pericardium kind of reminds me of the membrane that's around the brain. What is the toughest, thickest membrane around the brain called? The dura mater. It's really tough. Okay, so let's take a look at some of these membranes in a nice cross-section. Okay, so here is the heart within the pericardial cavity. Here is the fibrous pericardium that's been cut away. All right, so the most superficial part is that really tough fibrous, I need to move the cursor just a little bit. Okay, the fibrous pericardium that's suspending the heart, kind of like a hammock, holding the heart up. And then we have the parietal division right on the inner surface of the fibrous pericardium, the pericardial cavity with fluid. What kind of fluid is that? Serous fluid, or you could say pericardial fluid, but I was thinking serous fluid. Other people say pericardial fluid. And then here is the membrane that's right on the surface of the heart. That has a couple names. Since it's a part of the serous membrane, you call it what? The visceral pericardium. But since it's a membrane right on the surface of the heart, sometimes we call that the epicardium. So epicardium and visceral pericardium are the same thing. They're exactly the same thing. And then the next layer is no longer part of the serous membrane. That's a part of the heart wall that's filled with heart muscle. So that is what we call the myocardium. And then we have a membrane that lines every surface on the inside of the heart. And that's what we call the endocardium. Okay, endocardium. Remember a bone? What were the membrane? I'll be right with you. Remember the membranes on a bone? What's the membrane on the outside of the bone called? The periosteum. Okay, can you see this sort of a similarity with the heart? The pericardium, right? The visceral pericardium. It's the same. It would be like the periosteum. And what is the membrane that lines every interior cavity of a bone? That's the endosteum. And what do you have in the heart? The endocardium. All right, so there's a similarity in nomenclature there. Yeah.
So there's four layers there, right?
Okay, of what? If you're thinking about the serous membrane or all the way, layers all the way through? All the way through the heart? There's probably more than that. Let's look at them, okay? So what we're looking at on this slide right here is the serous membrane plus the layers of the heart as well. All together. All right, so we got the fibrous pericardium, that's one. The parietal pericardium, that's two. You got the cavity, that's three. You've got the visceral pericardium or epicardium, what's that, four. Then you got the myocardium, five. And then you got the endocardium, that's six. Okay, so you got those six layers right there. And don't forget the epicardium and the visceral pericardium are the same. It's the exact same layer. All right, so the way that I organize this in my mind, if I want to look at just the heart wall itself, the layers that make up the heart wall, we got a missing cursor. Where is it? Do you see it? Ah, there it is. All right, so the layers that make up the heart wall itself, endocardium, myocardium, epicardium. Okay, now the serous membrane. Don't forget, the epicardium is the same thing as the visceral pericardium. And then the pericardial fluid, and then the parietal pericardium, and then the fibrous pericardium. All right, so that's how I would categorize that, organize that in my mind. That's where that serous fluid is, right? And if you get an infection of these membranes right here, what do we call that? That's called trouble. Yeah, but anatomically, okay, in terms of disease, that's called what? Pericarditis. Okay, pericarditis. It could be a bacterial infection or viral infection, and that's an inflammation of this area right here. So fluid has a tendency to build up in the pericardial cavity, and that's going to hurt your cardiac function. As a matter of fact, it might be serious enough to even kill you, because what happens when the pericardial cavity fills up with fluid? Guess what it does? Okay. Notice that fibrous pericardium can't stretch. It can't stretch. It's like the dura mater, right? So when the pericardial cavity gets real thick, guess what happens to the volume of the heart? It gets squished down. Right? And in order for the heart to pump blood, when the heart's not pumping, guess what blood has to do? It has to fill the heart up. But if the pericardium has got the heart all squished down, it can't fill up with blood, so that when it contracts, how much blood is it pumping? Not very much, because blood couldn't get into it. Okay? So you can't have a lot of fluid. I think the most is, I forget what it is. It's either half a centimeter or 1 centimeter thickness. Probably maybe 1 centimeter thickness. And if it's greater than that, it's easy to get taken care of. How would you take care of that?
Antibiotics.
Okay, yeah, antibiotics for sure to treat the infection. Ah, but you just jam a hypodermic needle in there and suck some of the fluid out, and immediately the heart expands and it starts pumping blood again. Okay, but of course you want a longer-term solution to that too.
What? Myocarditis.
It could be due to a bacterial infection. How does it get there? Maybe a cut through your teeth, oral route, maybe if you scratch your eye, okay? Different kinds of organisms have different ways of getting in there. Somebody even got an MRSA infection of their heart one time from a toothpick that they stepped on and jabbed into their toe. And that almost killed them. It was just amazing that the cardiologists were able to save this person's life. Yeah? Visceral pericardium, same thing as epicardium. Yes, right. So that's like an interface. It's right between what, the serous membrane and the transmural layers of the heart. Okay. Okay. Or surgery. If you have any thoracic surgery, that's always a complication of thoracic surgery. Okay. As well as pneumonia and pleurisy as well. Okay. Okay. So those are the transmural layers of the heart. Okay, blood flow through the heart. You know, I kind of like that first slide in this chapter right here. I think you should know all of these, but you should know these valves as well. So could you answer this following question? How about if you trace a drop of blood around the circulation? Through both sides of the heart, through all the arteries and veins, at least the major arteries and veins, and passing by the capillaries and all the valves. Could you trace that around the circulation? Okay. How about if we just try that real quick? Let's see what we got. How about blue? Where do you want to start? Where's a good place to start? Right atrium. All right, so right atrium. Now, what kind of blood is in the right atrium? Oxygenated or deoxygenated? Right atrium. Deoxygenated. Okay, now I do have to say a little bit about that. There's some teachers that don't like that term because the difference between oxygenated blood and deoxygenated blood is pretty small. It might be only about a 5% difference in oxygen, but I like to use that term. Okay, deoxygenated means what? Relatively deoxygenated. Some of the oxygen has been taken out of it. Okay, so right atrium, deoxygenated blood. What does blood have to go past next? Yeah, tricuspid valve. All right, I'm going to abbreviate it. What's the blood like there? It's still deoxygenated. Then where does it go? right ventricle, and it's deoxygenated, right? Okay, now where does it go? Pulmonary semilunar valve, and that's still what? Deoxygenated, and where does it go there? Pulmonary, and you know what? You're right when you say pulmonary trunk, but I'm going to write it down just a little bit different. I'm going to say artery, okay, because what's interesting about this artery right here? What kind of blood does it have in it? Deoxygenated, right? And then it goes to the lungs, and in particular, what's the functional blood vessel in lungs where something special is happening? Lung capillaries. I'm going to say lung capillaries. Lung capillaries. Now, what's happening there? Is it deoxygenated blood? Some exchange, right? So, what? Yeah, CO2 goes out. I'm going to use two lines. And O2 goes in. So we're going to call this exchange. Okay, exchange. That's lung capillaries. All right? Now, where does it go after the lungs? Okay, it goes, or what organ does it go to? It goes back to the heart. Okay, and since it's going back to the heart, what do we call that blood vessel generally? That's a vein, and in particular, since it's coming back from the lungs, that's the pulmonary vein. You guys are all right. I was just trying to take another little step. So it's going to come to the pulmonary veins. What's the state of blood here? Pulmonary vein. So I'm going to put oxygenated pulmonary vein to the left atrium. Okay. Oxygenated, left atrium, then blood passes the bicuspid, and it's oxygenated to where? The left ventricle. It's oxygenated, then past the aorta, semilunar valve. How did I do it? Semilunar valve. It's oxygenated to the aorta. Ah, okay, what's next? Okay, yeah, you could say coronary artery, but I'm just going to I'm going to make it more general. I'm going to say systemic circulation, but the special part of the systemic circulation where something's happening is what? Systemic capillaries. Okay, again, and what's happening there? Exchange. So O2 goes out. Okay, CO2 goes in. That's exchange. And then it goes where? Aha, oh no, I lost some people. No, where does it, is it going to a vein or an artery? After the capillary, here's I better spell it out. Capillary. After a capillary goes into a vein, okay, and what's the name of the vein? It's bringing blood, and what is a vein? Something bringing blood back to the heart. And veins bringing blood back to the heart for systemic circulation are the? Superior. Inferior. Vena cava. Okay. And then, so what's the state of blood in the vena cava? Deoxy. Okay. And then it goes to the right atrium. And then that's deoxygenated. So that's the whole circulation. Okay. So probably you should write that down so that you could do that in 60 seconds is probably way too long. Where? Here? Aortic semilunar valve. Pulmonary semilunar valve. Bicuspid is what? Atrioventricular. Yeah. What did I forget?
With the blood from the superior and inferior vein, would it go to the coronary sinus?
Nope, they don't. No, they don't. Okay, that is the coronary circulation. Maybe I'll describe, I think I might have some slides on the coronary circulation. Coronary circulation is a circulation that feeds the heart with oxygenated blood, so it's a part of the systemic circulation, but it's really, really short. Okay, so I think I have a slide that I'll talk about that a little bit. So only blood returning from the heart go to the coronary sinus, and the coronary sinus is a huge vein. It's probably about as big as your little finger, and it drains blood only from the heart back to the right atrium. But the vena cava also drain blood from the rest of the systemic circulation, superior and inferior vena cava. Yeah. The body is right here, systemic circulation. All the capillaries everywhere in your body except where? Except in the lungs. Okay, so fingertips, earlobes, toes, kneecap. Okay, that's all systemic circulation. Yeah.
So basically, the right side of the oxygen, and the left side oxygen.
Yeah, do you see how that happens like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so half of the systemic circulation is oxygenated and the other half is deoxygenated.
And it always goes around. So
but, and how would you describe, wait, let me finish this before I forget. How would you describe, what's the relationship or what is the nature of the systemic circulation compared to the pulmonary circulation?
Antagonistic.
You know, it kind of looks antagonistic. I don't know if I'd say that, but it's certainly opposite, right? It's certainly opposite. That arteries in the pulmonary circulation are deoxygenated, arteries in the systemic circulation are oxygenated. It's opposite. Because the good way to always remember that is, why is blood going to the lungs? To get oxygenated, right? To become oxygenated. So pulmonary arteries need oxygen, so that's why they're going to the lungs, to pick up oxygen. Okay, yeah, you know what, I tell you what, I like this slide. Let me find my cursor and point this out to you. Okay, so you, what was your question now?
So it's oxygenated,
so here is oxygenated blood in the left ventricle, okay, and it's the heart is going to pump it past the aortic semilunar valve into the aorta, all right, and then this oxygenated blood is going to go where? Everywhere in your body except your lungs, all right, so it goes everywhere in your body, and your body then absorbs that oxygen. But there has to be capillaries. And when we get to the next chapter, you'll see why only capillaries allow for exchange. So capillaries everywhere in your body allow for oxygen to leave, but also what? Carbon dioxide to enter. So these veins are carrying deoxygenated blood from all the capillaries in your body back to the heart, because the heart's got to then pump it to the lungs to start that whole process over again. Okay?
When
it goes through the capillaries, yeah. When it goes through capillaries. And there's usually only one capillary bed in the systemic circulation. There's a couple examples where there's two back to back, but mostly there's always one. All right, so... so exchange takes place in these capillaries in the systemic circulation or in the pulmonary circulation in the lungs, but there has to be capillaries in the lungs for exchange to take place, yeah.
Do they have one function, or there's capillaries that bring oxygen in and capillaries that take oxygen out, or do they do this?
The capillaries in your systemic circulation down here,
yes,
always absorb oxygen. No, I'm sorry, release oxygen to tissues and absorb CO2. Capillaries in the lungs release CO2 and absorb oxygen.
But they're not separate.
Yeah, they're separate.
So they're separate.
Yeah, they're definitely separate. So the capillaries in the systemic circulation compared to capillaries in the pulmonary circulation are opposite each other in terms of exchange.
No, I understand that.
Okay.
What I'm saying, are they two in the systemic? Are there two steps of capillaries? One?
Nope, there's one set.
Okay, and they do the same thing.
They do the same thing. They exchange oxygen and CO2 at the same time. Okay, both of those processes can happen at the same time. Okay, and the way that these molecules move is just by what we call diffusion. Diffusion works by having molecules move from high concentration to low concentration. Okay, so it's passive. That's right, just passive exchange. So in order for your body to absorb oxygen, oxygen has to be higher in the atmosphere. And in order for your body to get rid of carbon dioxide, it's got to be lower in the atmosphere. Otherwise, it won't leave. There's no other way that our bodies work. Okay? Okay, we talk about that a lot when we get into a physiology class. Okay. All right, coronary circulation. Okay, it's just a subset of the systemic circulation. And the coronary circulation starts at the aorta. So here's the aorta right here. And there are two coronary arteries. There's a right and a left. All right, so I can see the right coronary artery coming off over here, and then the left coronary artery is coming off right over here. And the origin of these coronary arteries is right inside the valve leaflets for the aortic semilunar valve. They're way down at the base of the aorta. As a matter of fact, they're the only vessels that come off of the arch of the aorta. All right, so can you see this one right here? That's the right one. All right, so here's the right coronary, here's the left coronary. And then the left coronary branches right away or bifurcates into the anterior interventricular artery. Sometimes we call that the left anterior descending artery or LAD. All right, and then the other branch is the circumflex, which goes posterior to the heart. Okay, and then veins drain blood from the heart back to the right atrium, right? Here's one, for instance, the great cardiac vein goes all the way around the atrioventricular sulcus to the posterior part of the heart. Let me see if I can see the here it's coming around back the other side. And this is the coronary sinus right here, right? So coronary just means what, a blood vessel around the heart. And remember, sinuses can have different things in them, just depending. In this particular case, what's in this sinus? It's going to be blood, right? Like a paranasal sinus. What does it have in there? Don't gross me out. It's air, basically. Okay, with mucus, it's lymphatic tissue, okay? Immune response. Okay, and you can see the coronary sinus emptying into the right atrium right here. Okay. The fibrous skeleton of the heart. The heart is kind of interesting because when we look at a cross-section right here, right, what kind of tissue makes up this wall right where I have the cursor? As a matter of fact, tell me the name of this layer right here. That's the myocardium. That's muscle. And one of the things about muscle tissue is that it can act like a nerve. It can conduct electrical impulses, electrical information very easily, right? And that's going to cause the heart to contract. All right, so usually we only need one electrical stimulus in the right atrium and the whole heart contracts because these muscle fibers distribute that electrical signal.
Why the right atrium?
Oh, because of evolution shows us why. But I can't talk much about evolution. Okay, it's because our frog ancestors. Okay, that's where the pacemaker was developed. Okay, but that's really kind of beyond the scope of this class. All right, but you will see maybe why it's important for the atria to contract first, which is why it has a pacemaker compared to the ventricles. Okay, but notice that all of the valves are pretty much in this plane close to the base of the heart right here. Okay, and those valves are attached to what we call the fibrous skeleton of the heart. It's tough connective tissue. All right, it's not muscle tissue. And since it's not muscle tissue, guess what it can't do? It can't contract. Furthermore, it can't send electrical signals. It blocks electrical signals. So the atria are isolated from each other compared to the ventricles. All right? And if the electrical signals start in the atrium, it takes a while for it to get into the ventricles. So the atria contract first, followed by the ventricles because of that fibrous skeleton. All right, so what does that fibrous skeleton look like? Here's a fibrous skeleton. All right, so here's just a nice cross section. All right, and in order to see all these valves, how would you have to angulate that plane?
Obliquely.
Obliquely means from going from base to apex, you got to angle it to the left. But also, if you go from base to apex, you have to angle it what? Anteriorly as well, because the heart has that double angulation like that. All right, so it's a special kind of picture. So here you see the semilunar valves and the atrial ventricular valves tightly, right, glued to the fibrous skeleton so that they don't move around. And guess what? That's really handy in case you ever need a valve replacement. All right, guess where you sew it in? Right in that fibrous skeleton, which is like what? It's like shoe leather. Okay, so that's kind of fortunate that if anybody needs a valve replacement, it's kind of easy to sew it in right there. A lot easier than sewing it into a muscle, for instance, which is not as strong. All right, so that's the fibrous skeleton, and that is what? Dense, regular connective tissue. It anchors the valve cusps. It prevents over-dilation of the valve openings because if the valves have to come together to prevent retrograde flow, but if they get really spread out, what happens to the valve leaflets? They can't touch each other, they can't approximate each other, and then what happens? The valve is going to be leaky. So the fibrous skeleton prevents the valves from expanding too much. That happens in other parts of your body. Where can that happen in somebody's body? Where there's a valve that expands too much and then it stops working. And you don't know what other parts of your cardiovascular system have valves, so I'll just tell you really quick. Those are veins. All right, and if some veins expand too much, guess what happens? The valves don't work, and you get a condition called varicose veins, and blood doesn't return back to the heart. Okay, so those valves, leaflets have to touch each other. Okay, the fibrous skeleton also is a point of insertion for the muscles of the heart. All right, there's got to be an insertion. And it also blocks the direct spread of electrical impulses from the atria into the ventricles, making the atria contract first compared to the ventricles. Okay, yeah. You know it's not. Let's go back and look over here. Okay, so this septum right here is not really part of the fibrous skeleton. The fibrous skeleton is just what? It's just in this plane right at the base of the heart. Okay, it's right at the base of the heart. The septum, both the atrial septum and the interventricular septum, they're muscle tissue, so they conduct electrical signals very nicely. Okay. Now, you've probably gone over all this stuff in lab. This probably is an exam figure. All right, I'll go over it really quick. Right, this is just some of the internal anatomy of the heart. And as you look at this heart, that's like you're looking at my heart. Right, so where do I have the cursor? Let me put the cursor right here. So what chamber is that? Is that, because it's corresponding to my, what hand is this? That's my right hand, so that's my right side of the heart. The left side is on the other side. So it's like looking at my heart. So you got the right atrium, right ventricle, left atrium, left ventricle, separated by the interventricular septum. And then here is the interatrial septum, kind of hard to see. All right, the most anterior vessel coming off the base of the heart, great vessel, it looks really big. And in lab, you can kind of trick yourself. You can say, oh, well, that looks like the aorta, but it's the most anterior one. It's coming from the right ventricle, so it's not the aorta, it's the pulmonary trunk. All right, you might be able to get away with saying pulmonary artery, but proper word would be pulmonary trunk. All right, so here's the pulmonary semilunar valve, and then it bifurcates right away to the left pulmonary, and the right pulmonary artery goes underneath the arch of the aorta. So here's the aorta. Oh, you know what? On your test, I might have said this picture is an exam figure, but it's modified. I want you to add something to this. And there's three vessels that aren't labeled on this diagram that you should know. Okay? And look where we have them, right here. These three. Now, these are not the first branches coming off the... What are the first branches coming off the aorta? Okay? But the first... Okay, that's a trick question. Okay, so you see three vessels coming off the arch of the aorta, but remember, there's two vessels coming off the ascending aorta. Where's the ascending aorta? So here's the ascending aorta. What are the vessels coming off the ascending aorta? The right coronary artery and the left coronary artery. So don't forget about those that are tucked way down, and you're going to find them. Ooh. You're going to find them right within the cusps of the aortic semilunar valve.
What is it called?
The right coronary and the left coronary arteries feeding what? The heart muscle itself.
It's on the other side, the back.
The posterior. They're kind of anterior. They're right on either side. I don't know. I'll see if I can find a picture of where they are for you. Let me see. How about previous slide? No, right here. So here is a nice anterior view of the heart, okay? And here is the ascending aorta, here is the arch, here is the right coronary, and here is the left coronary. They're originating from right at the base of the semilunar valves. So if you're going to do a dissection in a lab, you got to cut way in there, and probably we don't even like you to do that because we would like to use the hearts again sometime. All right. But on this diagram, what are the additions that you have to know? The branches, exactly right, the branches off the arch of the aorta, all right, which is what, above the right and left coronaries. So the first branch off the aorta is the brachiocephalic, because it's taking blood to the subclavian as well as the common carotid. So brachio to the arm, that's what the subclavian does. The cephalic, the carotid takes blood to the head, right? So brachiocephalic, that should kind of make sense just by nomenclature to you. The next branch is going to be the left common carotid and then the left subclavian. So the brachiocephalic is doing the job of these two right here. The brachiocephalic is doing the job of the left common carotid and the left subclavian. All right. And in some animals, they only have two branches coming off the arch of the aorta. We've got three. But this is another example of what, some kind of strange asymmetry with respect to the heart. Right, we mentioned that last time, because where do you mostly have the heart? It's not right smack in your middle of your body. It's a little bit to the left, right? So it's already a little asymmetric already. Okay. And then blood comes back from the systemic circulation via inferior vena cava or superior vena cava. And then here are pulmonary veins. Now, why are these pulmonary veins shown in red? Because they are oxygenated, and they're oxygenated because blood is coming back from the lungs where they've picked up oxygen, right? So that makes perfect sense. Now don't forget, on the exam, are you going to see color?
No.
I hope not. Okay, it's going to be black and white. Okay. All right, so here you can see atrioventricular valve. Atrioventricular valve look a lot different than semilunar valves. So how could you tell me that an atrioventricular valve is different than a semilunar? The shape, they're a lot bigger. Atrioventricular valves are a lot bigger. That also means that they will flop the other way if you let them. They'll invert. What prevents them from inverting? On the margins of the leaflets for the AV valves, you have these chordae tendineae. And the chordae tendineae then are attached to papillary muscles. All right, so that's how you can always tell an AV valve, because of those chordae tendineae. There are other muscles inside the ventricle, namely the trabeculae carinae here and over here. How can you tell the difference between a papillary muscle and a trabeculae muscle?
A network. One looks like a network.
One kind of looks like a network, and the other one kind of looks like a
bulb.
Like a little bulb, like, kind of like a finger. There's a better way, surefire way, so you don't get taken by surprise. One anchors the chordae tendineae. One has chordae tendineae on them, and the other doesn't. So what about trabeculae carinae? Does it have chordae tendineae on them? No, only the papillary muscles. Because you might look at a pediatric heart sometime, or from a small animal, or maybe a right ventricle, and you're going to say, oh, I can't tell if that's a papillary muscle because it's so small, but if it has chordae tendineae on it, then it's got to be a papillary muscle. Okay? Okay, so make sure you know how to label all of these things, and you see some pectinate muscles here in the right atrium. Okay, this is a pretty good picture. Some pictures are not as good as this one, because which ventricle is bigger and thicker?
The right one, left one.
Okay, I heard two, but you got to only say one. Which one? The left ventricle, right? Because it's got to pump with a lot higher pressure because the systemic circulation is a lot longer circulation. It takes more energy to get blood flowing through your whole body as opposed just to your lungs. So what happens if you use a muscle more? What happens to it? It gets bigger and stronger. That's why the left ventricle is bigger and stronger, because it's working harder. Mm-hmm. The right ventricle has kind of an easy life. It doesn't have to be as strong. Yeah. Yeah, because as you go from base to apex, the heart actually does, the apex is anterior. So both atria are posterior to the ventricles.
Okay, so if you would look at a heart,
yeah,
would the right atria and the right ventricle, right ventricle,
okay.
More ventricle than
Oh, you know what? Not necessarily so. The left ventricle is more circular. Okay, so the left ventricle is more circular, and the right ventricle kind of looks like a pancake sitting on top of the circular left ventricle.
Okay,
so I have a cross-section I can show you. Do you want to see what it looks like?
Yeah.
All right, let's take a look. So we're going to make a nice transverse cut right through about this region of the heart, but don't forget, you got to angulate it, doubly angulate it, to make it go right along the long axis of the heart right here. And here it is. Here is this nice circular left ventricle, and then here is the right ventricle, which kind of just layered right on next to it. So one way you could think of the left ventricle, it kind of looks like a football. We call that a prolated lips, but the right ventricle doesn't have that shape at all. Okay, here? Yeah. That's how it would normally sit in your chest.
So they're not directly
superior and inferior? No, they're not. It's that doubly angulated kind of object. Yeah. Now, that's probably not so important for this class, because I'm not going to have you image anybody's heart, but if you were in the hospital and you wanted to get some really good pictures of somebody's heart, right, you're going to have to know those angulations so that you get nice pictures like that. Yeah, because when you pick up a heart, you go, oh, here's a heart. But how's that heart in you? It's like that and like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. It's 3 to 5 times thicker than the right ventricle. Depends on the person, depends on their activity level. I can't really say for sure. Okay, if you exercise a lot, your left ventricle is going to be bigger and stronger, of course, just like if you exercise your biceps, it's going to get bigger and stronger too. Other disease states, if you have hypertension, your ventricles will get bigger as well. And then if you have other kinds of disease processes, the ventricle is going to get really big, but then the heart wall starts to get thinner and thinner and thinner. And it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And that means your heart is on the way to dying. Okay? And we'd like to stop that process sooner rather than later. Okay, conduction system of the heart. I think this is our last topic. All right? And so when we say conduction, we mean conduction of electrical impulses of the heart. And one interesting thing about all muscles in your body is that they conduct electricity pretty much like nerves do. They're not specialized necessarily for that. What are muscles really specialized to do? To contract. Okay? But if you've ever touched an electrical circuit that has been energized and you got shocked, what happens to your muscles? They contract. Right. All right. So that electrical activity on a muscle cell is used to initiate contraction. It's not really used to send information like nerves are, but it's used to start contraction. And, for instance, if you're concerned about something having electrical electricity in it or not, and you want to touch it and see if it has electrical activity, how would you touch it? Would you touch it like this? Or would you touch it like that? You wouldn't touch it at all. That's the best. Okay. But how would you touch it? It's the palm of your hand or the back of your hand? Okay. Well, what muscles do you think are stronger? Well, that's one way to think about it, right? Your flexor muscles typically are stronger than your extensor muscles, okay? But if you touch it with the palm of your hand and it causes muscles, all the muscles in your arm to contract, since your flexors are stronger, what's going to happen? They're going to grab it, okay? That's really unfortunate because somebody just can't grab you and pull you off, okay? But if you touch it with the back of your hand, what's going to happen? You're going to pull away from it, okay? So if you're ever concerned or interested, don't ever grab something, okay, if it might have electricity in it, okay? All right, because all muscle cells use electricity to cause contraction. All right, so your heart is kind of interesting because it does not need innervation to contract. It is autorhythmic. It will contract on its own. And if you take a heart out of an organism, like a frog, a snake, a mouse, a rat, or even a person, right, if it's a normal heart and you put it in on the table, what's going to happen? Just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. That heart is going to, it's going to beat even outside your body, okay? So it doesn't need electrical nerves. It doesn't need nerves in order to tell the heart to contract. What nerves do on the heart is that it adjusts how fast it contracts. It adjusts the rate of contraction, but not whether it's going to contract or not. So that's different than skeletal muscle. What does skeletal muscle need to contract? You need electrical impulses coming from your brain, going all the way down to that skeletal muscle, right? So that's voluntary control. Your heart doesn't necessarily need that. So the heart needs a pacemaker to tell the heart when to contract, and the pacemaker of the heart is in the right atrium. And we call that the sinoatrial node, or sometimes we just want to say SA node, right? SA node. It automatically adjusts the heart rate. It will, what we say, depolarize. And I think I asked you guys to know what depolarization is. That's the first step of forming an action potential. That's when sodium enters a cell that initiates an electrical signal. Okay? And so that's what we call the pacemaker of the heart. Now, let's see. I don't think I have a picture. Do you have a picture in your mind of what a myocardial cell looks like? From when we first started looking at what is histologically, what does heart muscle look like? Yeah, it has an intercalated disc, it has striations, so it has a single nucleus. Skeletal muscle is multinucleated. So cardiac muscle kind of looks like skeletal muscle because it's striated, all right, but there's a big difference. Right, so here is, what kind of muscle is this? That's skeletal muscle. You knew that right away because it's just what? A linear fiber, right? And what is cardiac muscle? It has these branches, okay? And furthermore, okay, so those branches are pretty important, but cardiac muscles are short, and so they touch each other. One end of the muscle touches the end of another cardiac muscle. So this junction between cells, because they're short, is called an intercalated disc. So when this muscle contracts, it's going to pull away from this one, but the intercalated disc has what? Junctions in them that glue the cells together, so when they pull on each other, your heart just doesn't rip apart. That's really important. But it has something else. It has these little tunnels from one cell to another, so that electricity in the form of a sodium ion, and see this is an ion, it's got this little plus sign, can go from one cell to the next, okay, and then the next one and the next one, so electricity can flow from one cell to another. What did we call that kind of junction? And that's a gap. That's a gap junction. And all myocardial cells are connected to each other, at least the muscle cells are connected to each other with gap junctions, so that if you stimulate one to contract, what happens to all of the cells in the heart? They all contract. Yeah, because this electrical current can go from one to the other. Now, does skeletal muscle have gap junctions?
No.
And is that a good thing? Yeah, that's a good thing because, for instance, maybe you wanted to lift this marker up and you stimulate this muscle here. You don't want your whole body to do what? To contract all at one time, right? If it had gap junctions, that would happen. All right, but the heart muscle has these gap junctions. So not only on the surface of the heart, but the electrical signal does what? It goes to a deeper layer and then another deeper layer. It can go from right to left, but it can also go, what, from top to bottom through the whole thickness of the heart. So the heart contracts as a unit. All right, so the first signal starts here at the sinoatrial node. And since all muscles can conduct these electrical signals, both atria get stimulated into contracting. And what do these do when they contract? They pump blood, and they pump blood past the AV valves into the ventricles. Okay, and now guess what happens? Now the ventricles contract, and where do they pump blood? They pump blood into the arteries, the pulmonary, or the, here's the aorta right here, or the pulmonary trunk coming this way, what's not on this diagram. Okay, so the atria contract first. Now, why is that? What did we say? What's in this area of the heart right here?
Skeleton.
The fibrous skeleton. And can the fibrous skeleton conduct electrical impulses?
No.
It can't because it's dense, regular connective tissue, right? It's non-conductive tissue. So electrical activity in the atria are prevented from getting into the ventricles except through one special route. There's some specialized muscle cells. Okay, and even the sinoatrial node right here, that's a specialized muscle cell that depolarizes spontaneously by itself. When the atrioventricular node right here, and again, that's a specialized muscle, bunch of muscle cells, it's not nervous tissue, it's still muscle tissue. When that electrical signal gets to the AV node, what does atrioventricular mean? Yeah, it's right smack at the junction between the atria and the ventricles. It holds on to that signal, that electrical signal, for a split second, and then it sends it into the ventricles. All right, so here is a pathway going from the AV node into the ventricles, and this is what we call the atrioventricular bundle. See this, what is that, yellow or gold, something right there? Okay. All right, and then we can see it split into the bundle branches, the right and left bundle branches, as it moves, as that electrical signal moves into the interventricular septum. And now that signal is transmitted very rapidly all the way down to the apex of the heart, and then it comes back up the lateral walls of the heart, and then these little terminal branches of the conducting system are what we call Purkinje fibers. And then these Purkinje fibers stimulate the rest of the myocardial cells to depolarize. And that signals for the heart to contract. All right, so this conduction system is made up of these, what we call nodal cells, or just specialized muscle cells. Okay, so the atria contract, and then the signal gets delayed, so the ventricles still haven't contracted, and then the signal goes all the way down to the apex of the heart, stimulating these Purkinje fibers. And guess what part of the ventricles contract first? And does it make sense? It's the apical regions, right? It's down by the apex because this is where we have the Purkinje fibers. So this part of the heart contracts first, and then this part, and then this part, and then this part. And which way does that force blood? Yeah, from the apex up to the base of the heart and out the arteries. Really, because it wouldn't make much sense if the basilar regions of the ventricles contracted first, forcing blood down into the apex of the heart. It would have no place to go. Okay? Yeah. So the heart contracts down by the apex, and then that wave of contraction moves back up toward the base of the heart. Okay? So I think that's important for you to know. First, the atria contract, right? Followed by the ventricles, but in particular, the apical regions of the ventricles, then squishing blood up into the arteries, out of the heart. It just, that's a, just a natural rhythm. It has its own natural rhythm to do that. And that rhythm can be adjusted by the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. But even without any autonomic nervous system input, that SA node is going to stimulate itself. Okay, and yeah, we know why. Because of special little channels, sodium channels in there, but and we would talk about that in the physiology class. So you have to, but what should you take with you to understand that in the physiology class? You should know what an action potential is from this one. Action potential has got two parts. It's got depolarization and repolarization. So these nodal cells spontaneously depolarize all by themselves, which then send signals throughout the whole heart. There's a question, yeah. Oh, okay, how the heart contracts, okay? So these electrical signals, once they're delayed by the AV node, rush very rapidly down through the bundle branches down to the apex of the heart, and then the Purkinje fibers distribute that electrical signal, causing the apical regions of the heart to contract, and then that wave of contraction works its way back up to the base. So the apex contracts first, and then the next higher regions, and then the next higher regions, and finally both ventricles are completely contracting, forcing blood right out the arteries of the heart. Okay, so the basilar regions, the basal region of the ventricle, shouldn't contract first, because that's going to force blood down, and then it's going to explode or something. Something bad would happen. Okay, so, and this is... For instance, you might have seen on an ECG, you might have seen contractions of the atria being independent from contractions of the ventricles. And for instance, if somebody has a heart attack right in this region right here, guess what happens? It blocks that signal. So electrical signals can't get from the atria into the ventricle, so your heart will have two different rhythms. All right, we call that a heart block, and there are different kinds of heart block depending on the severity of that disease on the heart. Okay. And oh, sure. Absolutely. Anytime you would kill that tissue, then these conduction pathways are damaged, and that's going to drastically change the electrical activity of the heart and then how it functions as well. Okay. And since all heart cells can conduct electrical signals, there's another condition that's really dangerous. If there is damage, for instance, maybe to this part of the ventricle right here, okay, it's going to act like a pacemaker, and this one over here is going to act like a pacemaker. And what happens then, these electrical signals get all messed up, and maybe this part of the heart is going to contract, and then the contraction is going to move over in this direction, and then wind around on the backside and come down to the apex, and then wind around back up to the top of the heart. And so instead of the heart contracting, atria, ventricles, atria, ventricles, the heart is going to contract, but it's going to contract like this. So when the heart's contracting like this, is it pumping blood? It's just squishing blood around inside the ventricles, none is coming out. And when that happens, how long can you maintain consciousness when the heart stops pumping because it goes into this kind of condition? 3 seconds, that's right. We call that ventricular fibrillation. Okay, and then after what period of time is your brain dead? 3 minutes, right? So that's a really dangerous condition. And that's why it's really nice to have those automatic electronic defibrillators. And I think there's some around. I know the fire station down there has one. Maybe the health service has one. Anybody else know where there's one around campus? No? Ah, you should tell somebody to go get a bunch. Yeah? In each restroom has them? Nice. Yeah, I know Disneyland has got a bunch too. Okay. Yeah, it's probably going to be legislated sooner or later. All right, so you got to know all these different parts of the conduction system and, of course, why it's there. So fibrillation, no coordinated contraction, because synchronized depolarization is lost. The heart is depolarizing, but what? In just random pathways all over the heart, so the heart is not contracting in a unified manner. All right, so innervation to the heart, right, is by the autonomic nervous system. You don't have any somatic nervous system going to the heart. Parasympathetic will address the chronotropic effects on the heart. So what does chrono mean? Like this is a fancy chronograph. I just lied, but anyway. All right, that's a watch. Right, chrono has to do with time. right? Or rate. Okay, so chronotropic effect on the heart is what adjusting the heart rate, if it's going to be slow or if it's going to be fast. All right, and parasympathetic slows the heart rate down via what? What is, and that's the vagus nerve. What cranial nerve is vagus? You might have to know that next time. That's number 10. Okay. And parasympathetic nerve fibers go to the SA node and the AV node, but that's about it. They don't go to the muscle at all. All right, what's the other division of the autonomic nervous system? That is the sympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system. All right, and this comes from the cardioregulatory center in the medulla via what? Thoracic outflow. Sympathetic outflow is what? Thoracolumbar. It's not craniosacral. Parasympathetic is craniosacral. That's why it leaves the vagus nerve. All right, and where do these sympathetic nerves go to? They go to the SA node and AV node. So that's going to adjust the rate, heart rate. So that's another chronotropic effect. What's going to be the effect compared to the vagus nerve? What's the relationship? Antagonistic. So parasympathetic slows it down. Sympathetic speeds it up. Right? So sympathetic speeds up the heart rate. But there are also sympathetic nerves that go to the ventricles. Unlike parasympathetic nerves that don't go to the ventricles, sympathetic innervation goes to the ventricles. And when these nerves release norepinephrine, it increases the force of contraction of your heart. All right? And so when you have sympathetic stimulation, the heart rate increases, but the force of contraction also increases. And you probably all experienced that, right? Have you ever been driving down the freeway or in some circumstance, maybe you step off of a curb and all of a sudden you look down the street and you're like inches away from a bus that's going to run you over.
Yeah.
What happens to your heart? Oh, you can feel it like pounding and you're sure you're going to die, right? Your heart is just pounding outside your chest and it's beating very fast. So that's fast is what? Adjusting the chronotropy of the heart. The force of contraction is adjusting what we call the inotropy. Inotropic is a positive inotropic agent is something that increases force of contraction. A positive chronotropic effect is something that increases the rate of contraction on the heart.
So why is it?
Well, because it's part of the fight and flight response. Sympathetic nervous system is part of the fight and flight nervous system. So when you're presented with stimulus that you think is going to damage your body, the sympathetic nervous system takes over and your eyes dilate so that you can see. Your heart rate increases because in order for you to deal with that threat, you need oxygen and nutrients going to your muscles so that you can run away or you can fight, okay, that threat. And so that's what the sympathetic nervous system is for. And guess what else happens? Your respiratory rate increases and your airways and your lungs dilate so that you're more efficient in breathing as well. Okay, all due to sympathetic effects. So where do we see that? We see that, okay, right here. All right, so, oh wow, this is gray. What is that? Is that gray to you? Yeah? Green. We got green and then we got blue. All right, blue. Purple, green and purple. Okay, well, those are two nice contrasty colors. So here is the medulla. Here's the vagus nerve. Medulla is part of what? Your brain. Yeah, brain stem. So this is cranial outflow to the heart. Remember, the parasympathetic nerves only go to the SA node. Here's your SA node and the right atrium. Here's the AV node. This is going to slow the heart down. But here is sympathetic outflow. What can you tell me about sympathetic outflow? It is? In terms of anatomy, not in terms of function, but in terms of anatomy. What is sympathetic outflow? Is it cranial?
It's
thoracolumbar, right? So here is a nice cross-section of the spinal cord, right? So thoracic spinal cord. And can you see a cell body right here in the lateral horn of the gray matter? I don't know. I don't see it, but that's where the cell body is for this neuron. It leaves, what root is this right here? Ventral root, enters the spinal nerve, all right, and then goes into the ventral ramus, and then the white ramus communicantes into the sympathetic chain. It goes up a division where it synapses, so this is all the preganglionic fiber. Here's the postganglionic fiber, right, leaving the sympathetic chain ganglia with the sympathetic cardiac nerve going all the way to the heart where it innervates the SA node, the AV node, but also the myocardium. Sympathetic stimulation on the SA node and AV node increase heart rate, so that's what we call a positive chronotropic effect. When it goes to the ventricles, that increases the force of contraction. That's a positive inotropic effect. All right, so it's going to speed up the heart plus the force of contraction. Now, oh, I didn't go over it, but we could probably go over it. What fiber is this right here? That's the preganglionic fiber of the parasympathetic nervous system. And what's this one right here? That's the postganglionic. So again, can you see that the sympathetic preganglionic fiber is short? The postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic nervous system is long? And it's the opposite for the parasympathetic nervous system, right? The preganglionic is long, the postganglionic is short. All right, so that's probably something that you got to know for the test on Wednesday too, right? And which one's myelinated? You don't see it on this slide right here. Which one's myelinated? The preganglionic is myelinated. That's why this thing right here is called the white ramus communicantes, and this one back over here, that's the gray ramus, because the postganglionic fibers leave that route sometimes and they're not myelinated. All right? Okay, I did see a question. Where is that question? Yeah. So if I give you this picture right here, you know what? I know this is not an exam figure, so I can't give you this one. But you should probably at least know what sympathetic outflow kind of looks like, was thoracolumbar. Yeah. If you see something going into the chain ganglia, what would you say, parasympathetic or sympathetic? And I kind of abbreviated the term, because if I used the whole proper term, it would tell you. What are the chain ganglia? It's called the sympathetic chain ganglia. And the sympathetic chain receive thoracolumbar outflow, sympathetic outflow. They're little auxiliary spinal cords for sympathetic signals on either side of the vertebral column, right? Okay. All right, so I guess I'm not going to start the vascular system today, because you don't have to know that for the test. But over the weekend, start reading through that, print out the notes, and start looking at that chapter, because I need to make up a little time. Seems like I'm about a lecture short on time. And I don't want to take it all from the reproductive system. What's the function of the reproductive system anyway? Huh? To procreate? Not really.
That's what my grandmother said. That's all you need to
know. That's all you need to know. Okay. Well, okay, so we're going to proceed through very fast.
We got a moment.
Yeah.